meeting on the forest management issues, and our state forester, Marvin Brown.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Marvin Brown, the director of the Department of Forestry, the state forester. With me is Jim Paul. Jim is a division chief in charge of state forest management. And you had asked that we come and give you just a brief overview preparatory to a hearing you're going to have on Thursday dealing with the state forest management plan and authority. And so we wanted to do that. We've got a letter with a little information, and then we've boiled down what we think are the basics to about five handouts. And I'll talk about a couple of those and then turn it over to Jim. In the letter, I think the things I would point out, first of all, are there's four properties that are generally identified as state forests most often, a class of the Tillamook, the Elliott State Forest, and Sunpass State Forest, north of Klamath Falls. But beyond that, we do have a lot of other scattered tracts, and we've got one table here that we want to show that to you because we think that's pertinent to some of the issues that are going about management costs and things.
If you have a cell phone.
It's not mine.
Other than in the off position, it can still do that. So even if it's not ringing or anything else, it will interfere with our sound system. So
I think I'm clean.
I'm good too.
I just have crutches, no pacemakers.
Okay.
The other thing in the letter, just wanted to let you know that the board has, you know, been hearing the concerns that have been expressed primarily about the Tillamook and Clatsop for ever since I got in this job in 2003, really, and have been working through that deliberatively, you know, in a fairly disciplined fashion. They did at their last meeting last March adopt what we've identified as a set of performance measures that they feel like if we are meeting those performance measures that we are, in fact, meeting greatest permanent value. And they're going to use an assessment of how we're doing on those performance measures to have that discussion in June. Do they, in fact, think that the current forest management plan for the Clatsop and the Tillamook are meeting greatest permanent value? And if not, you know, we will be bringing to them some thoughts about how we think it could do a better job of doing so. So just some progress on where the board is with that issue in the letter. I would like to cover attachments 1 and then attachment 2 and then turn it over to Jim. Attachment 1 gives you an overview of the basic authorities under which we manage. The number one thing I'd point out there is that we manage two different kinds of land. One of those we call Board of Forestry Lands because they are, in essence, under the policy direction of the Board of State Board of Forestry. The other are the Common School Fund lands. And they are under the policy direction of the State Land Board, which are the governor, the treasurer, and the secretary of state. They each have distinct authorities in terms of what they direct, how they direct those lands to be managed. Looking first at Oregon Statute 530, we manage the Board of Forestry Lands for what is called the greatest permanent value. And the thing I would point out in that paragraph is that this is what I call permissive language on a part of the statute. It's not prescriptive. It says we may manage these lands for such things as recreation, timber production. It doesn't say we shall. It says we may. The Board of Forestry has gone on in their duties to further define what they think greatest permanent value means. And we've talked about that under Oregon Administrative Rule 629, the second paragraph there. The key words that they added in their definition are that it means actively managing these properties. That is a key part of the authority that we try to address, that we are actively managing them, that they're managed in an environmentally sound manner to produce sustainable timber harvest and revenues. And this is a sentence in that second paragraph. This management focus is not exclusive of other forest resources. So that's the administrative rule under which we operate, that managing for timber revenues and volumes are not exclusive of other forest resources. Jim will go through some of the additional flow there. But after the board approved that rule, they also approved a forest management plan. It's several hundred pages long, and it was adopted as administrative rule and sets the basic standards and goals that we use. Once the board approved the forest management plan, then it's handed off to the Department of Forestry, the state forester. And the state forester adopts an implementation plan and annual operating plans that get more specific about what we're going to do where on the ground each year. The Common School Fund lands have started as a constitutional authority. It is a constitutional language that describes who is responsible for those properties and being the state land board. There are language in statute that identify the state forester as the person who will manage those under the policy direction basically of both the state land board and the Board of Forestry. And we follow a similar process there of crafting a management plan that is approved by the state land board for common school fund lands, and then from that we develop our own implementation plans. So does anybody have any questions on the authorities before I move on to page two? Again, there's two distinct types of land, and that's the big...
There are other forests that are county, small pieces of county land that you manage within the context of larger ones. Would they come under the first group?
They come under both, and that's a perfect segue into attachment two, actually. if you flip over to attachment two, this is the distribution of lands by county. And BOF obviously is Board of Forestry lands, CSL or Common School Fund lands. You can see we have a pretty wide distribution of both types of land in a variety of counties. Clearly, you can start to pick out, you know, where those big properties are that everybody identifies. We have 310,000 acres in Tillamook County. We have 146,000 acres in Clatsop County. The Elliott is in Coos and Douglas County, and you can see under the Common School Fund land column there, 54,000 acres in Coos, 35,000 acres in Douglas. So you can start to see where those bunch up. But then beyond that, we've got a lot of land in either category that is scattered. And, for example, we have 9,000 acres of Board of Forestry lands that are managed as part of the Elliott State Forest. So that becomes something of an accounting issue for us to keep costs and revenue streams separated for all of those properties. But it's important in that, you know, as I was telling Jim, you know, it's kind of like peeling back layers of an onion as we keep looking at what's driving costs and revenues on these properties. I think part of the issue is how scattered they are. And that might be something that needs some addressing. Is there a way to consolidate, bring these more efficiently together, both from an accounting and a on-the-ground management standpoint? I do think that has something to do with how costs are driven in our whole system.
Yes, Chair. Sure.
In looking at that, that was exactly my question, was does it make sense that you have 90 acres in Linn County that's common school land, and you know what would be a reasonable, because you're right. I mean you're probably just going to swap acre for acre, and maybe there's some value in, you know, 1 acre is better than the other, and I don't know how you would do that, but I can't imagine it makes your life, actually I shouldn't say that, your life easier, but it doesn't make sense from a physical standpoint to have this separation. I don't think.
Yeah, Chair Roblin and Representative Meyer, that's exactly right. The problem is, as I see it, you know, I think, you know, Jim and I have talked about this enough that we're going to start probing this pretty deeply. But you end up with losers and winners then in terms of what goes to the Common School Fund, what goes to the county fund, what counties gain acres, what counties lose acres. And there's a whole ugly box of, you know, political questions there that are going to have to be dealt with as part of that. I don't say that to say we shouldn't try to deal with it, but I would guess that's why it hasn't been dealt with very effectively in the past.
Follow up. Yes. Just a comment. I mean, the whole ugly box of O&C and everything else is open. So, you know what, we might as well air all of the dirty linen as far as these lands and get it out on the table, because we need to address it statewide. And I'm not pointing a finger at you, but, you know, federally and state. And so, you know, if the time is right, then we probably need to move forward.
I think it's a good observation.
Other questions? I guess, do you have off the top of your head the number of acres that are in federal land?
Jim's got a last slide. He's going to talk a little bit, but just in general terms, you can see here, our total is 781,000 acres. Federal lands amount to 16 million plus acres in Oregon. We own about 3% of the forest land. Yeah. As I pointed out to someone the other day, we harvest about 7% of the timber on 3% of the land. So I'm going to turn it over to Jim to talk about some of these additional attachments, unless you all have some more questions on attachment two.
All right. Thanks, Marvin. Good afternoon, Chair Rowland, members of the committee. I'm going to first, attachment three, cover briefly the Elliott State Forest, and then I'll talk a little bit next about the Tillamook and Clatsop specifically. On attachment three, you can see at the top there, it kind of summarizes the most recent direction that we've received as an agency from both the Board of Forestry and the Land Board in regards to the Elliott. Essentially, we've been directed to continue to pursue to try and gain approval of the draft HCP that we currently have drafted, however, with the caveat that that's consistent with the draft forest management plan that accompanies that HCP. So we are continuing in those negotiations. A pretty key to that, though, as we proceed, I would say, is that we do remain consistent with the forest management plan, and to the extent that we can do that, as I get to down below, you'll kind of see what we anticipate the effect of having that revised HCP would be. The table there looks at the historical harvest levels, specifically for the common school lands that are on the Elliott State Forest. And this looks specifically at the financial picture, of course, financial returns, but I would say in terms of the forest management plan that we've been operating under since 1995, roughly half of the acres of the Elliott are little to no management as part of the HCP we're currently operating under. So the vast majority of these dollars and feet of this volume comes from the other portion of the forest. Having said that, you can see we've got in column one, going back 10 years, the volume that we've harvested off of the Elliott, the value of that wood that was harvested. That's the gross value of that wood. And the next column shows the expenditures, our costs basically incurred to manage the Elliott, but those are the district-specific expenditures. And the next to last column is the essentially the cost-to-value ratio, just considering the expenditures in the Coos District, but I'd like to direct you to the final column there, which incorporates the Coos District's proportion of some of the expenditures that are centralized, that come out of Salem, essentially, for fiscal services, infrastructure, types of things that are distributed across the state. If you look at that, which is essentially a representative of a cost-to-revenue ratio, you can see our performance for the Elliott, I think, has been relatively good with a couple of exceptions. And in 2003, we saw our second highest number there in terms of cost to revenue. And then, of course, our last complete year, 2006, was by far the poorest performance financially. Part of the reasons for that are back in the first column, if you look at the volume, where you see we also had our lowest volumes in that year as well. Generally, our expenditures have been relatively steady, meaning some incremental increases over time, but not large swings up and down in either direction. But if you look at our volume and associated value of that volume, that's where we tend to experience some pretty wide swings, a lot of which are beyond our control, either have to do with market conditions, threatened and endangered species issues, that sort of thing. You can see on the 5-year and 10-year averages, we're starting to see, on average, less volume we're able to produce under the current plan out of the Elliott, and that's one of the important reasons why we are looking at revising the HCP. And looking out into the future, at the bottom table there, you can see the harvest levels we are projecting out into fiscal year 2010. I would say the farther we get out there, the more speculative that is. In other words, we're uncertain in terms of what type of threatened species issues may arise that could limit our management further. That's specifically if we continue to operate under the current HCP. Under the revised HCP, there in the right column on that bottom table, those are estimates based on some modeling that we've done where we've put in the assumptions and parameters of the draft forest management plan and accompanied draft HCP that we are pursuing right now for approval. I think I'll leave it there. It's as much as I wanted to say, and take any questions from you all if you do have any before I move on.
Sorry, I had to go get some ice.
Representative Dingfelder.
I'm sorry that I was out at the beginning dealing with an injury here. But a question I had, and maybe you mentioned this in your comments, was is the Coos District the only district that's involved in management in the LA? Are there other districts as well?
Chair Rowland, Representative Felder, the Coos District does manage, is the one district that manages the LA State Forest.
So are the expenditures that are listed here, are those all your expenditures for management? Because we discussed this in the Ways and Means Committee when DSL's budget was up, and there was some concern about the cost of, DSL's, the ratio between, since they contract with you to manage the Elliott, and how much from the Common School Fund was going to offset, the cost of the department of ODF for managing. And I recall that they were different numbers than this. So I'm curious if you can reconcile those numbers for me.
Sure, be happy to do that. These numbers are expenditures specific to that district and for Common School Fund land management on that district.
Mm-hmm.
We have costs, of course, on every district related to Common School Fund, as well as costs that originate out of our Salem headquarters office. So this just represents the piece of those costs that are associated directly with the operations on the ground on the Elliott. So that's why in that last column that's in bold, factored into that are those costs that are shared statewide, the Elliott's proportion of those costs for expenditures coming out of Salem. I would also add to that, I would say these numbers aren't represented here, but we have looked at our numbers in terms of the proportion of the value that we're getting out of the Elliott for the Common School Fund relative to the total value that we're getting out of all Common School Forest lands.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially the Elliott over the last 10 years, it accounts for about 89% of the value we're getting off of the Common School Forest lands. The costs that are associated with the Elliott are only about 56%.
Okay, follow up.
Yeah.
So when you say 56%, that's management costs for the Department of Forestry and Department of State Lands, or is that just Department of Forestry's management?
Department of Forestry.
I might jump in, too. We talked about Attachment 2, I think, before you got in the room, Representative Dingfelder. And what that relates to is if you look in this column, CSL, that's all the Common School Fund lands we manage.
Mm-hmm.
We manage 124,000 acres, roughly, statewide. Of that, the Elliott's about 82,000 acres. And so I think one of the points we're making a little bit earlier is that one of the things that's driving management costs is how scattered those remaining 40,000 acres are. And so when we say that 56% of the Common School Fund costs we incur are related to the Elliott, the other 44% are related to all these other properties listed in this column here, while those other 44% of the cost only generate 10% more revenue, 10% of the total revenue.
Okay. And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I mean, we'll be reviewing your budget in a few weeks, so I'll probably be, what I'd like to do is meet with you beforehand and maybe go over specifically costs for the Elliott, because I do, especially since with the HCP, now that the HCP is, well, it's almost, I guess it's going to be done in what, a couple of years?
Less.
By the spring of next year is our target right now.
Okay. Because the concern that I had is just looking at this over time. I mean, your costs haven't gone down, although the harvest, because of the HCP, the harvest levels went down a lot, and hopefully they'll go back up once we have that HCP in place. But the management costs didn't go down, so we've been taking out a greater percentage, a if I'm understanding that right, even though because the harvests have been down. So it would be helpful for me if I could just get the amount overall, including the Salem and management costs that are being attributed to the Elliott, and we can talk about that offline, but before your budget hearings.
That would be great. One clarification I make on that, harvests have been going up and down on the Elliott. And in FY05, we harvested 33 million feet, and in FY06, 11 million feet. And that's kind of the nature of timber harvesting in a lot of respects. Most of the timber sales are usually operated on over a period of several years, 3 years maybe. And the operators may get in there and do a lot of the sale the first year, or they may wait and do a lot of the sale the third year. It gets scattered out, and because of that, you see pretty wide fluctuations between between one year or the other. And I think it's important, in my mind, to use 5 and 10 year averages. Mm. And 5 and 10 year averages do say we are going down, but it's not the kind of wild fluctuations. I think we're going to continue to go down because, in essence, as Jim said, we've only been able to operate on half of the property at this point. And that's going to continue to pinch our ability to operate in the future if we're not able to change that. But I think it is important to know that there's a lot of variation from one year to the next.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Gifford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, if you explained why it was there was this dip in fiscal year 06 to below half the historical cut, volume of cut, failure, I didn't absorb it, so run it by me again if you did, first time if you didn't.
Sure. Chair Roebling, Representative McPherson, I'll take a stab. Last year, one of the things we saw was the operators were holding back on actually operating on the sales that were sold. So the volumes that were registered as harvested were low, even though the sale, what we put on the market and actually accepted bids for was higher than that. It hadn't all been harvested. So we'll see some of that get caught up in this current year. There'll be some of that move into this current year that should have been in last year. But there's also was some additional constraints from endangered species, marble murrelet, which we do not have an HCP on right now. So we have to do take avoidance for marble murrelet. And I think I may be wrong. Did it take out a sale or two that we had planned? I can't remember.
For 2006, I don't recall. It's our practice that we use is to always have a certain number of alternate sales that are ready to go just in case we are incurred by a murrelet that shows up. We've averaged about 25% of our sales actually get encumbered, so we try to have about that percentage of alternate sales waiting in the wings. Now, again, we don't know if one year we might see 50% of our sales become encumbered or another year zero, so it does vary. And I can't tell off the top of my head to what extent that happened in 06. I could give you a vivid example of what Marvin was just talking about in terms of the wood not moving, as we say. Some of the financials that we track sort of month to month is how did we do this month versus the same month last year. And in August and September, we were seeing 5 to 10 times the amount of volume being harvested off of the Elliott as we did in the previous year, which I believe speaks more to the fact that in 2006 for some unusual market conditions, which in talking to the district were pretty localized all up and down the coast, they weren't seeing this type of thing going on. Those unusual conditions, for some reason, was precluding the purchasers from deciding to exercise their sales and waiting until the next year. Our contracts give a 3-year window for purchasers to conduct their sales.
Okay, just summarize what I think I'm hearing is that the drop to half the historical average in the fiscal 06 was an anomaly, and that you do expect that these projections that are down below, which are at the historical average more or less, will that you expect to achieve those. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. That's the ones at the bottom. Oh, yes, the first column, the second column.
The FY07 through 10. And I think Jim pointed out, and I would agree wholeheartedly, I'd say 27.5 million feet in 09 is probably optimistic because we are seeing more and more constraints with the existing HCP. I really would be very surprised if we could get to that level.
Representative Klein.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's what I was going to comment on. We heard testimony when DSL was in front of Ways and Means about this topic, and people on the committee started looking at the amount contributed to the Common School Fund, said, wow, what happened? And the same answer, take avoidance strategy puts way more off limits than with a conservation plan that goes about that sort of species recovery in a different way. But I didn't see these numbers with current as a projection in that budget. We didn't talk about that, but I wonder whether you can really get back to that. I mean, that revised plan is really important. I'm not sure we even get this far without it.
Okay. Answer? Yes.
Because I don't know, and I don't care who answers, how much do we put in on a historical average the Common School Fund?
Anyone who knows that is in the back of the room.
I could
tell you. Oh,
there she is. For the last 5 years, we have produced about $66 million for the Common School Fund.
and that is total. So 66 divided by 5 is something. Okay. $12 million a year in the Common School Fund. And under the revised HCP, what would that figure go to, ballpark? A third more, half more, double?
We don't have those estimates in front of me. However, it would track very closely to the proportional increase in volume, with allowing for some fluctuations in market conditions and the quality of the wood. But it would be at the same magnitude. So if you look at right now, we've averaged about 26 million board feet. If we are able to get to 40, you're in the ballpark of a 50% plus or minus increase in terms of volume, which would translate into something similar for value, all things being equal.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Well, okay. I one other question about did you talk about what's included in this expenditure? Is that for FTE? Is that for putting together, you're going out to bid for the harvest, so is it, you know, overseeing the contractors? What is included in that expenditure number there? I know this isn't the Ways and Means Committee, and I'll have another bite at the apple when I'm there, but I think it would be helpful for this committee to hear what services you're delivering with those expenditures.
Chair Roldman, Representative Feld, would you like to answer right now, or are you asking
for information? Well, I mean, just general. You don't have to break it down.
Essentially, these expenditures are all of those expenditures that are conducted at the district, and billing comes into Salem as being associated with activities on the district, which include not limited to everything that happens on the ground in terms of posting sales, serving for sales, any type of billing or contract work that actually is done on the district.
Equipment costs, and as well as overhead costs that are charged back to all of our programs from Salem.
So personnel would be part of that.
And how
yes.
many
personnel?
Chair, just follow up. How many FTE are in that district?
I would need to get back to you with that information.
I'm sorry. One last question.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is, if you were not encumbered, and all you were doing is maximizing harvest for sustainable yield, what would our annual yield be?
If we weren't encumbered by endangered species. The Douglas Timber operators put together a model. Assume some tick avoidance on owls and murrelets, but were assuming not near the kind of issues that I think we typically run into on endangered species. They came up with about 65 to 70 million board feet a year, and I'd say, you know, the land is capable of producing at more than that, 75, 80 million board feet a year. There's no denying that. It's good growing land. But, when we put together an HCP that hits 40 million board feet a year, what we're locking in is the certainty that it will stay there and not get constrained, not run into issues about what owls and murrelets are going to show up in the future. And it's just my own professional recommendation that we do try to lock in if we can, because I think we would have a lot of, we could, and I've told others, we could write a plan that harvested that much, but I think it would be risky to assume that we would ever actually implement a plan that harvested that much because of the endangered species issues.
So if a sustainable yield was 65 or some figure, and we're harvesting 25 million board feet currently, I'm assuming that what we're not doing is we're not harvesting that delta, that difference. And so what happens in 30, 40, 50 years? I mean, that wood doesn't go away. And what happens the next time we have a big fire?
If your concern is the fuel loading issue, you have a lot more margin for error in that country on that issue than you do in eastern Oregon. It can carry a lot of wood and not be, the kind of fuel issue that you see in eastern Oregon. In essence, we're going to be harvesting large trees. That's the history on the Elliott, is to harvest larger than average trees. And for that, we've continued to get better than average prices. There's a market that has sustained itself in that area for large-bodied wood. And that's what we'll be doing, is harvesting big trees on into the future. Now, is there some point there where it just kind of collapses on itself? If it happens, that's a long, long, long way out.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. We'll let you continue then. Moving on to attachment 4, numbers in terms of historical harvest levels on the Tillamook and Clatsop state forests. Just to say a couple words about the management plan on these forests, they fall under the Northwest Forest Management Plan, which, when it was adopted in 2001, also included some direction for the department to pursue a draft HCP that was developed alongside with the plan. We have not done a lot recently on this. We've been focusing our efforts on the Elliott. That's one of the reasons. Another reason is that because of some of the deliberations going on with the board, it made sense to hold off, I guess I'd say, until we have some clearer direction going to the future from the Board of Forestry. These numbers here, again, look to the revenue picture primarily, and there are some margin notes there in terms of some sort of notable events that occurred along the timeline. You can see the Board of Forestry volume that was planned back to 2001, the associated revenues to the counties for that year. Of course, in 2001, the adoption of the management plan, one of the pieces of information that went into development of that plan was some modeling that we did, an earlier version of the model that we are using today, an earlier version of our data that at that time projected that we thought we could achieve about 90 to maybe 95% in terms of timber volume as compared to a quote-unquote wood emphasis approach. That plan was adopted, put into effect in 2003. The implementation plans for that plan was approved, and those implementation plans included a harvest level target, a midpoint target of about 179 million board feet. Then moving into 2006 is when we completed sort of the latest version of the same of the modeling effort in terms of being able to project out what the plan could achieve. We essentially beefed up the model significantly. In fact, I don't think it looked much like the original model. We had much better inventory data to run through that model. And what that model showed us was that we could, under the current plan, probably achieve about 177 million board feet, very close to what we had implemented in our implementation plans. However, in terms of a comparison to what might be achieved through a quote-unquote wood emphasis approach, that would still be within sort of the statutory charge of these lands, it's looking now like we could achieve maybe about two-thirds of what that approach would be. So that was a significant piece that has triggered, I believe, the discussions at the board level in terms of
we need to take a look at this plan and just confirm or reconfirm how we want to move forward in the context of greatest permanent value. You can see the projected harvest levels below that for 2007 and 2008. And because we are still operating under the current forest management plan, which is a Board of Forestry adopted plan, so as long as those are the plans we have, we are going to stay consistent with the modeling effort and our best information in terms of what we believe those plans can achieve. Any questions on that?
I will ask one. There has been in his force discussion back to when the discussion was happening about the Northwest Forest Plan that we could harvest at rates substantially higher than that. I mean, there was a number that was put out there for the counties, and I cannot remember exactly what it was. But could you give an explanation as what it was and then why that hasn't been approachable?
Sure, Chair Roblin. You'll notice in this sheet, in the parentheticals there, there's a statement about the relatively what the forest management plans to achieve. And I think in 2001, we knew there were a lot of issues with the model at that time. It was a fairly crude model. And we wanted to be careful that we weren't looking at that too closely to depict exactly what we could achieve on the ground. In fact, one of the authors of the current model, John Sessions, at OSU, a quote from him recently was, "You got to remember that all models are wrong. Some models are just more wrong than others." Well, the 2001 model was definitely more wrong than the 2006 model. Because of that, trying to land on whether an absolute number is the right number is problematic. But what is valid, I believe, from that modeling approach as well as our current, is the relative difference between the two. And that relative difference in 2001 was almost zero. There was a belief that we could achieve very close to, if not the same level of volume under structure-based management as what we could under a more wood emphasis approach. Our current model, which is a very different model, different inventory, a lot of different assumptions, so it's somewhat apples and oranges if you compare absolute numbers, but I think the relative comparison is you can look to compared to what 2001, and that relative comparison showed it looks like under structure-based management, based on our latest information, we're probably only could achieve about two-thirds of the timber volume compared to an industrial approach. So that's kind of the way we sort of like to talk about the initial model versus the current model.
With this the new model, we did collaborate with some timber interests to say, okay, you know, if you were going to build a wood emphasis model, one that really emphasized wood production on forest, what would it look like? And they helped us build that, and we ran it through the model. And that number ended up, was it 130 million feet or something a year? I can't remember the exact.
Above.
It was 330.
It was 330 million
feet per year versus the 177 that our current management plan models out at.
So you gave an estimate for the Elliott a little while ago about what kind of production you could have on there. What's a similar number here? Are we getting to big logs here as well? I mean, is that what we're moving towards?
Over time, that would be the case. The Clatsop and the Tillamook are two pretty different forests. The Clatsop and the eastern portions of the Tillamook already have a lot of large timber on it, and we're harvesting generally larger timber there than on the lands in Tillamook County. But over time, they will all migrate to a fairly large diameter log. And the number, if we stay under the current plan, the number, this 2007-2008 number 185-186 is probably about where we should be if we're going to implement the current plan as it's described right now.
Other questions? Yes.
And that's to expand that just a little bit. So back to the Elliott Forest, you said fuel loading is not an issue there. But I can't believe the Tillamook is in that same category.
By and large, yes. It's not an issue in the coastal properties. It's just a much more moist environment.
Yeah.
and the frequency of fire is much less. I mean, we certainly worry about fire, and there's times when those properties will burn, and obviously the Tillamook burn is an example of when that can happen, but it's not... it doesn't happen with the frequency that it does in eastern Oregon.
Right. But the,
at all.
Okay. But the damage is still, or that when you, the Tillamook burn originally was with large diameter trees. Or was it, or had it burned before and so you weren't, I'm questioning the, I understand coastal timber in that fire dynamic, but it's not, it doesn't seem to, the Tillamook burn, I guess, is my right. Outside the standard deviation and going, well, this doesn't necessarily make sense. So.
If I could add to that, Chair Roebling, Representative Maurer, I believe, aside from the fire issue, which in terms up and down the coast range, I won't believe there's a significant difference in return interval historically, somewhere between 100 to 300 years return interval, but I think maybe what the more important differences between the Elliott and the Tillamook is what's there now. The Elliott right now has a very large percentage of older stands, 80 to 120-year-old stands. The Tillamook and the Clatsop are predominantly younger stands, so we don't have a lot of volume relative to the Elliott currently, and under the structure-based management approach, we do anticipate adding standing volume over time to create the structure that are part of the goals of the plan that look to creating about 50% of the forest as being either layered or old forest structure. But at some point out there, which is a ways, anywhere from 100 to, or anywhere from 50 to 150 years, depending which model you look at, we do, under the plan, we do see it eventually flattening off to some sort of sustainable level where we're maintaining the existing distribution of stand types and would presumably not see that continued accumulation.
Okay.
Are we doing, on our forests as opposed to what's happening in the federal forests, are we doing thinning and that kind of stuff on all these forests? I mean, part of the buildup of fuels is not just the buildup of bigger trees. It's the big, it's the buildup of dying trees that are getting crowded out because they aren't thinned and cleaned out. Are we doing that in the state forest in our structure-based management plan?
Yes, we are. Both what we call pre-commercial thinning as well as commercial thinning are regular practices that we use on an annual basis as part of our incorporated into our annual operation plans and how we manage the forest.
There's actually been more acres thinned as part of our harvest activity than clear cut over the last couple of years on most of those properties. It's starting to turn switch to the other way right now. But
and do we do contracts for the thinning? Similarly, where they take wood, we clean it out, we get a little bit of the profit from that.
Okay. Yes, we do.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thanks. Okay, I'll move on to Attachment 5. I won't spend too much time on this. Marvin's kind of gone over some of the pieces in this figure earlier, but this is sort of a very general figure that shows kind of the policy planning and implementation, how it all fits together. You can see a sort of box number one there is the revised statutes that we work under. So that summarizes Attachment 1. Beneath that, we have our administrative rules that where the Board of Forestry adopted, where they defined what greatest permanent value means. Below that, the Board of Forestry has adopted the forest management plans as OARs, and that, in essence, that's our plan for how we're going to achieve greatest permanent value. And then below that, we have the Department of Forestry's execution of those plans. And part of that includes both a longer-term implementation plan as well as our annual operation plans. In the implementation execution, we have our monitoring program and analysis that occurs. We have our adaptive management piece of what we do. We've also what we call the second-party audit and are looking to, in the future, having potentially regular third-party audits sponsored by the Board of Forestry. All of these pieces and the execution of the plans result in a certain level of social, environmental, economic outputs consistent with GPV. At that point, the box points back up to the question, the ultimate question, are the forest management plans achieving greatest permanent value? And that's a judgment, obviously, for the Board of Forestry in terms of we're implementing the administrative rules that define greatest permanent value. And therefore, what's the feedback in terms of an evaluation to see if, in fact, greatest permanent value is being achieved? At the last board meeting, just last week, the Board of Forestry adopted its initial, for the first time, a set of performance measures. There are nine of those measures that, in total, are intended to describe what greatest permanent value means. And in June, the board will have the opportunity to use those measures, look at the status of those measures, and essentially try to answer this question and determine if we are currently in the current plans achieving greatest permanent value. Part of that June meeting, as you note in the letter we've referenced there, is bringing forward some suggestions in terms of possible plan improvements as a way to help them evaluate those performance measures and decide where they sort of believe the right target is for those suite of measures. So the outcome of that determination, if it's no, we are not likely to be meeting greatest permanent value, that could lead to pointing back to the forest management plans, administrative rules, and looking at how improvements could be made to ensure that we are meeting it. If the determination is yes, we are likely to, we would continue to implement the current plans and do what we can in terms of continuous improvement to ensure that we're doing all that we can under those plans to achieve the full range of values that are part of the greatest permanent value.
Any questions?
The last slide was simply it's a context slide. This is actually from the Board of Forestry's long-term strategic plan called the Forestry Program for Oregon. Some of you may have heard from it. And the only reason I added this to your packet was just to point out that the state forest is just one piece of the broader picture of forest lands in Oregon. As Marvin mentioned, state forests make up about 3% of our forest land base. The federal lands, which are predominantly the nature emphasis forests up top, make up 57% of the forest land base. And just as a frame of reference in terms of what state forests have been able to produce, in recent years, the last two or three years, the volume that has been harvested off the state forests has either been exceeded or about the same as federal forest lands. I believe in 1 year recently, the federal forest lands may have exceeded us, but we're right around the same, in the recent past, the same level of harvest level. So, as Marvin also said, we're producing about 7% of the harvest in Oregon on 3% of the land base. So, in a relative sense, that's sort of the contribution state forests are currently making. And I just wanted to sort of lay that out to you so you can see that there are four general types of forest lands that we do look at as a department and that all play a role in terms of providing all of the benefits that we derive from Oregon's forests.
Okay. Any further questions for these people? Well, I personally want to thank both of you. I think it is important to have a context of where we're at in our forestry, and hopefully that will help us with questions as we go towards some bills that are coming up. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair.
We'll close our informal hearing, and we'll take a short recess, and we'll get a few more people back so they can work. So just take a deep breath, and we'll be 99. And who do we have coming up? I'll let you give a short explanation first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 99 is the bill that amends the Oregon Forestland Urban Interface Fire Protection Act. There was a concern expressed at the hearing about the notification requirement that's in Senate Bill 99 that requires the seller of property to notify the buyer that the property has been designated as Forestland Urban Interface property. So there is in front of you a -3 amendment. It took a couple times to get it right. So we have 99-3, and what that amendment does is delete the provision in the original bill that required the seller to notify the buyer, and in its place amend ORS 105-464. If you turn to page 11 of the -3 amendment on lines 27 and 28, there's new language there that asks the question whether the property has been classified as forestland urban interface.
So, okay.
So the large amendment is really it's a reprint of the seller statement that you fill out when you.
Mm-hmm.
So, would you like to hear from the people who worked on this and came to this conclusion? Or do you want to put it on?
If you would like, Mr.
Well, I'm just saying if anyone else is there. And did you get an explanation?
Yeah, I'm assuming if there's agreement.
I'm afraid I haven't, and I apologize, Mr. Chair. I was way when
this is Senate Bill 99, which, when did we hear it?
A couple weeks ago, March 1st.
Was that the day? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And it has some concerns with regard to notification issues. So we had some people work on it, and they came back with these amendments.
Harlan looks like he really wants to come up and say something.
we can have our forestry and Harlan come on up.
So the Dash 3 amendments, are the differences from the Dash 1 amendments the point that Mr. Levy raised before about notice?
Yes, but they've come with a unique way to solve it. They actually went to another statute that requires a document to be filled out during a sale, and they inserted in that document the language that they needed.
Mm.
So if you look at the Dash 2s on page 13, or page 11,
Dash 3.
On page 11, they added, has the property been classified as forest urban interface? And yes, no. So there is a disclosure statement when you are...
This whole document is...
Page 11. That all is in statute. So with that, why don't we open up for a couple of explanations of what's going on here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I want to thank the Department of Forestry for working with us on this amendment. If you recall, I testified on the bill a couple weeks ago. We were concerned with the vagueness in the disclosure statement in the original bill. It was on page 7. It was lines 24 and 25. So in the meantime, we've been working with the Forestry Department. And what we decided was we definitely wanted this to be part of the disclosure, but we wanted a little sidebars. We wanted to specify exactly what needs to be disclosed. So what we did was we took the seller's property disclosure statement, which is the Dash 3 amendment before you, and we just added the one question. It's on page 11. It's identified as letter I, and it just it asks the question: has the property been classified as forest land urban interface? And the seller checks the box: yes, no, unknown. If the seller checks the box yes, you see there is an asterisk next to the I. That means the seller has got to provide additional information to the buyer as to what that means, and presumably they would submit the information that they received from the Department of Forestry or from their county committee on this. And if they don't have that, they will at least write down that, you know, we don't know what happened to that piece of paper, but you should contact the Department of Forestry and they'd be able to provide one for you. So this would put the buyer on notice that the house that they're buying does reside within a forest land urban interface. I apologize the length of this amendment for one question, but that is what happens when you have a statutory form.
Yeah.
But with that, I'm happy to turn it over to my friend here.
Chair Olin, members of the committee, I'm Rick Gibson, the department's fire prevention manager. Maybe just by way of real brief review, the homeowner, property owners are required to do certain things under the act, and then they're supposed to self-certify their property that they've done so. That self-certification automatically terminates when the property is sold, and the theory is that the new owner then has to renew that certification and do the work. When that certification automatically expires, there is a potential liability of up to $100,000. And that was our concern, was that those buyers need to be aware of that potential liability that's out there so that they will hopefully take the actions to take care of their property and certify the property. We've had this requirement of notification in administrative rule, but it's basically hidden over there. And so by moving over to statute, we're trying to make it more visible. And I think Harlan was right. The original wording was a little bit ambiguous. So we like this change and would wholeheartedly endorse it.
So the other parts of this change are deleting, we insert this where this particular form resides, and then we delete lines 24 and 25 on page 7, which takes out that ambiguous language. And then on page 8, we, after line 9, we insert ORS, going back and making sure that we've got this back in there again. So as part of the disclosure statement, must be in a substantive following form, and then we list that. Okay.
Mr. Chair, quick yes. question. If I can recall the exchange the last time, there was a question whether or not owners knew that they were in the forest-urban interface, and how did they know? Because I don't know.
They wouldn't know. The hope is that by having to fill out this form at the time of your when you're buying, and this must be filled out with this signature.
So the owner that truly didn't know, I mean, and you know, I suppose if you live in the city, that's pretty obvious. But if you live in this nebulous area and you check no, are you subject to exposure? I mean,
yeah, Chair Roblin, Representative Maurer. There's a lengthy process that we're required to go through to identify the lands that are subject to the Act, and there's several places in statute where we're required to make a mail notification to individual owners, and we're required to hold some public hearings. So we're confident that the current owners know what they're supposed to do, and then we send them a whole packet of information. I saw Representative Clem was reading some of that a while ago. Okay. The current owners know. Our concern was if you buy a piece of property, you won't know, and this would fix that.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions of this group? I see Representative McPherson looking hard.
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just looking up the where this appears in the statute, and I think I'm trying to tell quickly what the consequence is. Kind of follow on to Representative Maurer's question. That is, it looks to me as though it's not a warranty that would give a remedy after closing, but that it would be a required disclosure that could, if were inaccurate, would impair the sale. That is, this person would have a right not to close if that were the case, if this were inaccurate. Is that? But that's a horseback kind of guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson. Right, the seller's property disclosure statement is not a warranty, but what it is a representation of the things the seller knows about their property. Now, if they choose to misrepresent things that they know and don't disclose or don't or rely on the form, that's a misrepresentation of a material fact that could result in legal consequences. We do have the form does allow them to check unknown. If they truly don't know, you'll see that all the questions allow for a seller to say, I really don't know. The purpose of this form, again, is to have the seller tell the buyer all the things that they know about the property. And over the years, the form has undergone modifications. We've added a question here. We've subtracted a question there. But it's been it's been in the statute for about 15 or 20 years now.
I'm sorry. So the issue is, if someone knew that they were in the interface. Let's not use the interface because that's not. But property fill. If you go up on page 11, line 9, it says, does the property contain fill? If the seller just out and out lied, they knew there was fill on the property, the purchaser, going months or years down the road, could prove that this was actually a chemical landfill, and the previous owner knew that and lied, that clearly they are subjecting themselves to civil action.
Chair Roblin, Representative Maurer, that is correct. That would be a misrepresentation of facts.
Okay.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Can you still sell your property as is? Can you avoid the seller disclosure?
Chair Roblin, Representative Smith, you can. You are not required to use this form. However, if you choose as a seller not to use this form, you are giving the buyer the opportunity to revoke their offer up until closing. And I can say we haven't done a statistical analysis, but based on anecdotal evidence from our members, probably 95 to 99% of the sales that are subject to this do use this form. The realtors are advising and the attorneys are advising their clients to use this form because you don't want that open-ended ability for a buyer to basically get cold feet up until the time of closing. Upon using this form, the seller is only giving the buyer 5 days, 5 business days, if they choose to revoke their offer. Then they're locked in, and if they walk, they would lose their earnest money. So that is why this form is very often, if not almost all the time, used when properties are sold.
So the forfeiture of earnest money occurs if you don't revoke within the 5 days. So if 5 days is an opportunity to say deal's off because of what's in the form, and then you get your earnest money back. Is that right?
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson, statutorily that is correct. However, the terms of the contract usually provide a contingent for an inspection. The form that most of my members use has an ability for a buyer to revoke upon disapproval of a home inspection, assuming that they want to use an inspection, which is usually a very good idea, and then they get the results back, then they have a few days from that period of time to revoke their offer and receive their earnest money back. But that is that's a contractual agreement as opposed to what the statute provides, which is an automatic 5 days. Unless they choose not to use this form, in which case they have up until the time of closing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Okay.
I see none. Thank you, Bill, for coming.
Thank you.
I would entertain a motion for the
Dash 3. Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 3 amendments to House Senate Bill 99. Is this
Senate Bill 99. Representative Smith has moved LC's 3 amendments, dated 3/13/07, Senate Bill 99. Is there any discussion? Any further discussion? I guess we could have done that before. Seeing none, let's have a roll call. Those in agreement will say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative
Boquist?
Excuse.
Representative
Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative
Bauer.
Aye.
Representative
Smith.
Aye.
Chair Robles. Aye. Having received the proposal, it is now amended. I would...
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. I'll move Senate Bill 99 as amended to the floor of the DPAS recommendation.
Representative Smith has moved Senate Bill 99 as amended. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Those responding with a yes, or those with a no. Oh, sorry about that. Opposed, a no. We'll hear it. Our roll call.
Representative Clinton?
Yes.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Boquist? Excuse. Chair Rowland?
Aye. Motion passes.
Do you want it on a consent calendar?
Do we want it on a consent calendar? Or do we want? I would say probably not, just because we have one of our members gone. So, Carrier.
Okay, Mr. Representative Maurer.
I'll second that.
I think you'd be a great carrier.
I think you'd be great.
Is that okay?
No, okay. Absolutely.
Representative Maurer will be our carrier.
I'll carry the water.
I have no letter.
So we'll close our work session on Senate Bill 99 and open. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2973. So we'll have a short explanation.
I just want to know where this handy fire-resistant castle is. Is that up by Tillamook?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2973 makes changes to the Forest Smoke Management Program. It modifies functions of the Forest Smoke Management Advisory Committee and creates a combined minimum non-refundable registration fee for Class 1 forest land. This bill does currently have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but we've been advised by LFO that it probably doesn't need that. So we given this letter to the Speaker's office asking about rescinding that referral, but we haven't received it back as of yet.
Okay, so we have, we might as well have both people, Charlie Stone from ODF and Mike, is it Dagsta? Thanks, you. Mike, OFIC.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Charlie Stone, policy analyst for the Protection from Fire Program with the Department of Forestry. The smoke management program is Oregon's way to regulate and manage prescribed forestry burning on forest lands in the state. It's been around now since 1969. And it deals with all the forest lands, whether they're private lands, state lands, federal lands. And it's our way of complying with the Clean Air Act and making sure that we protect public safety, public health, and visibility while accomplishing important forestry work. In 2002, we initiated a smoke management review committee to look at the program, see if it needed any updating, improvements, and what might be necessary to accomplish the next round of the Department of DEQ has to prepare a state implementation plan for approval by the EPA to keep us in line with the Clean Air Act. And after about 2.5 to 3 years of work, that committee published I think it was a 119-page book full of 39 key recommendations to improve the smoke management program, an already good program. And then staff got a hold of those 39 recommendations and put together an action plan or an implementation plan of about 61 different actions that the Forestry Department is going to take. Most of these things are technology improvements, procedures improvements, and rulemaking that the Board of Forestry is taking up. But there were just a handful of the recommendations that, in order to carry those out, required some legislative action and change to the statutes. So that's what the House Bill 2973 is about, those handful of recommendations. I'll just summarize very quickly two of the main effects that are in the bill. One of them, the committee felt that we should begin to collect emissions data on wildfires. For many, many years, we've been collecting data on prescribed burning. But one of our main principles of the need to conduct prescribed burning is that it helps to reduce emissions ultimately and reduce the threat of wildfire. When you do prescribed burning, you're burning at the right time of year under the right meteorological conditions. Yes, every once in a while the weather changes and we have a little bit of a problem, but the whole design is to take the smoke up and disperse it away from communities and do it at a time of year when you're burning the least amount of material to achieve the job. When you have a wildfire, you're burning whole stands of timber. You're doing it in the summer when there's inversions and communities get smoked out for a week or two at a time. And so that's one of the key principles. By actually gathering data about wildfire, we hope to prove the point over time that that we need prescribed burning as a tool to manage public safety ultimately. So when we talk about public health in protecting people from smoke, we would argue that the smoke management plan protects people from smoke by preventing wildfire and doing it at the time of year when it's appropriate. The other key effect in the bill is to change some of the clauses in statute that deal with how we charge burn fees to landowners when they're conducting burning. Right now, the statute says, the key piece says that we have to send out monthly billings for the registration fee and monthly billings when we then get information about they've accomplished it. We have a registration fee of 50 cents per acre. This is all an administrative rule. And then a burn fee that's currently $5 an acre for the accomplished burns. You may register a lot and not accomplish it. You only pay the burn fee on that which you do. The proposal is to allow the Department of Forestry to enter into agreements with the federal government, with the larger landowners, anybody that's got a good record of payment history. Instead of sending them a billing every month, which if they burn 2 acres, you know, you're sending them out a bill for $10. Let's accumulate that over 6 months or a year by this agreement and then pay it all at once. The department will save money in processing. The landowner will save money. The whole system runs more efficiently. There's a few other word changes and things in there that are described in the written testimony, but that's the essence of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
One other clarification, and I have that, and hopefully everybody understands, the Cascades tend to be a natural barrier in our state, and we treat people differently on each side of that depending on the kinds of things. And this bill kind of codifies that a little bit with regard to Hood River and where it lands one way or the other with respect to those fees. And I just thought a simple explanation that might be helpful.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for asking that question. Right now, the way the rules are structured, only those lands, those Class 1 forest lands in Western Oregon are subject to the burn fees. And in fact, they're subject to the smoke management instructions. The Forest Service lands on the east side, we have several, the Mount Hood and Deschutes forests are specifically included in the plan. Some of the other forests are voluntarily through agreements, and some of them voluntarily without agreements. We plan through the rules to expand requirement to follow the plan to all of the forest lands across the state. But we don't intend, at the recommendation of the review committee, to extend the burn fees to those private lands in eastern Oregon because of the concern that the added cost and the low productivity of those lands could cause people to stop burning, and that would be a bad thing in terms of fuel loadings and concern for public safety. So we've tried to put wording in. Right now the wording in the statute says that you charge those fees to regular or Class 1 lands in Western Oregon. If we now move that, it just says Class 1 forest lands. And if we now open it up to all of eastern Oregon, there are Class 1 forest lands in Wasco and Hood River County that we had no intention of extending the fees to. And so this language deals with that. It's an oddity. I don't know how to say this politically correctly, but it seems that Hood River County goes Western Oregon or Eastern Oregon, depending on the advantage. This probably wasn't very politically correct. The statutory definition of west of the summit of the Cascades in our fire statutes says that Hood River is Western Oregon. And so we had to kind of make this. It doesn't apply to Eastern Oregon, and Hood River is part of Eastern Oregon. That's a long explanation.
Okay, I appreciate that. Excellent. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Ingvelder.
Is this a new fee?
Chair Rowland, Representative Ingvelder, no. The fees have existed since 1991. The forester is allowed to adopt the fee in administrative rule and change that from time to time, but it's been in existence. Right now it's the sole funding mechanism, other than a couple of contracts with the feds for the smoke management program. You're going to see in short order another bill, House Bill 3468, that addresses restoring funding mix that also includes general fund and harvest tax as it was prior to the general fund shortfalls in 2003. But that's separate from this bill. The answer to your question is, yeah, the fees have existed since 1991.
Okay, so I'm just curious why this is not, you know, why the referral would be rescinded, because since it's part of your budget.
The fees are, it's a revolving fund type situation. They actually aren't that tied to the budget. The budget authorizes the expenditure of other funds, and then we collect enough fees to keep the program operating within that. Does that, am I making sense?
Yeah. Well,
there is another bill that's following that will look at these fees plus others to pay for this deal.
And that one does go away.
I was going to say, that makes sense.
That one will be going away.
Yeah.
So this is a companion bill.
Yes.
This is strictly policy with LFO has indicated very minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions so far? Seeing none.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Chair Roble, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Dykesel, Director for Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. As a member of the review committee that Charlie referred to, and this is our document, 119 pages, that took 30 months to to accumulate, and coming out of it with 39 recommendations. I was sitting back there in the last hearing thinking about the average of just over a recommendation a month over 30 months. So there was an awful lot of deliberation between a very diverse 11-member group. And to the group's credit, we came out with all consensus recommendations. All 39 were supported by representatives of the public at large, from healthcare professionals, from several county health programs. It was, in my mind, a very good piece of work, and took, like you say, a little over 2 years to accommodate that. And I represent, like you say, the industrial forest landowners, and I'm also a representative of the statutorily appointed Smoke Management Advisory Committee that was referenced earlier. Our charge was to take that program that was already very successful. It was the nation's first smoke management program, and continue to take it into the next century. And that charge was taken very seriously. But as you can see there in the directive that down there in the second paragraph is basically it sets up an inherent conflict when you're trying to prevent smoke resulting from burning in forest lands from being carried to or accumulating in designated areas or other areas sensitive to smoke, and at the same time to provide maximum opportunity for essential forest land burning. And after the committee's extensive deliberations and those coordinated recommendations that you're going to see today in 2973 is the policy recommendations. I believe next week or the week after, as Charlie alluded to, 3468 will be dealing with the funding aspects. And at the same time, we've been working extensively with Oregon administrative rule revisions with the Board of Forestry and the Environmental Quality Commission, where actually all the recommendations are going to turn into hopefully a finished product. And finally, our overarching goal that we came out of those 30 months with was to provide the maximum opportunities for land management objectives to be met while continuing to maintain air quality, health standards, and visibility objectives. Burning can be managed more effectively with improved coordination, communication, technology, public education, increased utilization of forest fuels, and maximizing burning during optimum burning conditions. And I can't improve on any of the things that Charlie went through as far as the program needs, the history, and I'm here to also support the bill.
Any questions?
Yes. Actually, one question. It's about the collection of information on wildfires. Do we not do any of that currently?
Chair Roland, Representative Maurer, we collect quite a lot of information about the wildfires and in terms of fire reporting. What we haven't been doing in the past has been converting that into emissions and inventorying that information. It's actually going to be a very simple process. It's one of the reasons we got a minimal fiscal impact, because it's a couple of changes in a computer program to take that fire reporting information, run it through a model, and then archive that emissions information, make available to other people. So we have we collect the data, but we haven't been transforming it into emissions data.
And follow up, is there going to be public disclosure or something brought back to this body to show those comparisons? Because I think the result may actually be pretty startling.
In the Board of Forestry's rulemaking package that is under process right now, one of the rules requires that the smoke management program evaluation and periodic improvements, and it requires reporting of that type of information and a whole lot of other information on a regular basis. So, yes.
Is part of that report back to the legislature, or is it in general?
That's not specific in the rules, but it's create the report and make it available to the public.
You may ask for that.
Yes, sir. You could ask the board.
So, any other questions for this group? Nope. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any other people here who wish to speak to House Bill 2973? Seeing none, we will close our hearing on House Bill 2973.
He's
signing
a letter.
Okay.
Oh.
He
did
sign a letter.
Okay, cool.
Well, I will open a work session on 2973.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I'll move House Bill 2973 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the rescission of the referral to Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2973 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, having received the rescind from Ways and Means. Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote. Those wishing to support will say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Boquist, excuse. Representative Clinton?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye.
Chair, would you like a motion to put it on?
I think that this one, I think I feel pretty comfortable with going to consent calendar. I would love that motion.
Okay, I'll make a motion and put it on the consent calendar.
Is there anyone who disagrees, objects to this being on the consent calendar? Seeing none, so ordered. So, House Bill 2973, having passed, will be sent to the consent calendar. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
We're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2974. Let's have a little explanation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2974 would create two additional exemptions to the existing requirements for scenic highways under the Forest Practices Act. The first new exemption would be harvest within an urban growth boundary, and the second, harvest within zones designated for rural residential development pursuant to an exception adopted to the statewide land use planning goals. There is no subsequent referral on this bill. No revenue impact statement, and the fiscal office has issued a minimal fiscal impact statement.
Okay, so we have with us Ted Lorenzen from Oregon Department of Forestry and Ray Wilkerson of OFIC. Does Ray want to come on up?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Ted Lawrence, Assistant State Forester for the Private Forest Division of the Department of Forestry. This bill is really quite simple. Basically, the Forest Practices Act requires that roadside trees be left along highways that are designated as scenic highways, regardless of zoning. And from our experience, we've learned that leaving roadside trees is not necessarily a very good idea in rural residential and urban growth boundary areas. We have authority to waive those requirements. In practice, we do that. That requires an alternate plan. This would basically eliminate the requirement we get out of the process of having to go through the paperwork to waive those requirements. So we think this would be an efficiency measure. Would allow us to allow our stewardship foresters to spend their energy and time on issues that are probably more substantive to the state of Oregon at this point in time.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just have one simple question. How does this affect Highway 30, the scenic highway, the Columbia River Scenic Highway? And I know we've been through that before, but I just want to make sure.
Oh, the Chair Rowland and Representative Smith, the highways that are currently designated as scenic highways do include Highway 30, and it would retain that designation, but to the extent there are rural residential zones or urban growth boundaries that road goes through, would then exempt those lands from that requirement. Now, I do have a map, and one of the things you will find that the red and the green represent the things, and it's hard to see, but there are some more detailed maps that I did provide you that represents Highway 101 around Lincoln City. Characteristically, along these corridors, you do have a fair number of RR zones, and even urban growth boundaries. I don't know the extent that Highway 30 would be affected, but you could certainly see go another direction. It captures a fair amount as you go into Clatsop County. The detail's not adequate as you get to the east and Multnomah County. Again, the detailed maps, looking at Lincoln County, I would estimate probably a third or more of Highway 101 is within one of those two kinds of zones, if not more. And again, routinely, we just waive that requirement. What we've found is when you've got fixed infrastructure, it just doesn't make sense to require trees. On highways where you do just have traffic, it's a much different situation where you've got fixed infrastructure. So this is an efficiency opportunity.
Representative Dingfelder.
I just have a question for Ted, and that is, Have you coordinated this with DLCD at all, since we're talking about statewide planning goals? I'm just curious if the department's weighed in, or if we can ask the department about this, or since we're dealing with rural residential zone GGBs and statewide planning goals, I'm curious if they have weighed in, or you've talked to them about it.
Chair Robel, Representative Dinkfeld, we have not talked to them directly about this. We have talked to them quite a bit about the issue of forest practices within urban growth boundaries and rural residential zones generally, and within urban growth boundaries, basically, city governments can elect adopt regulations. Most cities have done so, like Portland, Salem, Eugene. The smaller ones haven't. And that was a fairly clear policy option for city governments. Within rural residential areas, it's much less clear about what kind of exemptions to forest practices local government can take. It really, the statute says you can't regulate forest practices, you have to prohibit them. And we've had this tension amongst local government and the Department of Forestry on what that really means. DLC has been very consistent with our interpretation of that. But with regard to this particular matter, we've not really asked them. I don't think they'd have a position, probably would be my guess. I think they would probably agree with us that the infrastructure issue results in a practical outcome that we're going to waive 99.9% of the time, and it would probably make sense in their mind. But if you'd like me to get feedback from them, I'd be happy to do that.
The main thing is not that I don't trust you. It's just that we're talking about statewide land use planning goals, and I would just want to know what their opinion is on this, and, I think it would be good for this committee just to hear from them on that.
Chair Roland, Representative Dinkler, I would make the point the Forest Practice Act, though, is expressly exempt from the statewide land use planning goals and from the city agency coordination requirements.
Right, but you're talking about within UGBs.
Yeah, so we'll check with them.
Thank you.
Representative McPherson. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lorenzen, I understand, I think, the policy issues around a blanket exemption, a statutory exemption inside urban growth boundaries, because there's a full density of infrastructure. Our exception lands, the rural residential lands, strike me as being something different, and I'm just wondering whether the same policy that of a blanket exemption would be appropriate there as opposed to an administrative process, which is apparently what you're following now.
Chair Roland, Representative McPherson, I guess it ultimately depends upon the perceptions that people would have about how well scenic buffers fit within infrastructure areas like rural residential zones, but typically along the scenic highways we're talking about, you've got power line corridors, you've got more development. Again, the scenic highways tend to be the major state routes and the interstate highways. So our experience is that it's just not prudent. In fact, when I asked folks, do we have any good examples of buffers that we've retained where we've actually had a problem with blowdown, the answer was, well, we waived pretty much every request that we're aware of in those areas. So in a practical sense, this wouldn't change the outcome. I guess from my experience, this scenic highway buffer where you've got fixed infrastructure, it becomes very problematic to have a stewardship forester say, I'm going to take the risk on not waiving this. And so, from the administrative standpoint, this is one of those things where we really are left in the catch-22. If you don't waive it and the trees blow down, the landowner is exempt from liability, but the state forester gets the black eye. And so that's really kind of the risk here. On the highways where you've got basically traffic issues, it's a much different situation, but that's been our experience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
Representative Blum.
I hate to do this since we're going to be dealing with this in 25 minutes, but there's potentially going to be a bunch more areas which would be in limbo. Measure 37 doesn't restore rural residential zoning necessarily. It's I'm thinking more ag, and I don't know if timber works the same way, but there are areas that were RR5. Now they're EFU. You'd get a waiver to let you use them like they were RR5, but they wouldn't. I don't think the underlying zoning actually changes. That's not really spoken to here. Where would someone who's using it like a rural residential zone, but technically is not in the exception part of the statute because it was a waiver that allowed it, what would happen with those?
this is explicit in terms of what would have to be designated rural residential in the county's plan. How Measure 37 ultimately might work out, that's going to be a real challenge. And one of the things the department's struggling with is the chart that you saw in the discussion on state forests, where you've got kind of the residential forest component. Some of the elements of the Forest Practices Act just don't work very well there, and this is certainly one of those components that we're struggling with, how to implement something that really designed for forests that are intended to be managed for other purposes and residential uses. There are other examples, again, where we're really struggling with application of some of these provisions. There is no doubt that if Measure 37 claims were fully implemented, the amount of residential conflicts and the amount of residential type forests is going to increase dramatically. And that, I mean, just to put some context on that, state forests provide about 300 million board feet of timber a year. The family forest landowners are pushing 600 million. They could produce half a billion board feet more than what they're producing now. And certainly something like this doesn't influence that outcome at all, but it definitely is a major concern to us.
I follow up. I think we could probably deal with that portion later then, depending on the outcome. It just seems like, you know, again, exercising your Measure 37 rights, does that relieve you of all your obligations, including this one? You know, it's a tricky situation.
Chair Roland, Representative Clem, I would make the observation in terms of the exemptions that are provided under ballot Measure 37, it's probably fair to say that the scenic highways would not fall within the likely exemptions. So there is a relatively higher risk here as well from ballot Measure 37 claims, though the requirements themselves are kind of a temporary constraint on management. But again, as a practical sense, the approach of leaving buffers in these areas where you've got infrastructure just as a lose-lose for what we're trying to accomplish.
Okay. Mr. Wilkes.
Mr. Chairman, Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. Very, very briefly, I'd just like to get on the record we support this bill. The department has convinced us that this is a very time-consuming and administratively burdensome task for them in these areas, and by passing this bill, that will free them up, hopefully, to their field staff to have more time to do more important things. This is probably, in our view, the least important part of the Forest Practices Act. It is a has nothing to do with environmental protection or the health or productivity of the forest. It's an aesthetic provision, basically. And we support the provision, but in these areas, based on the experience they've had with administration, it seems logical that the exemption is warranted, and we would support that.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Paul. Is there anybody else for that? No one else. Anyone else that would wish to speak to House Bill 2974? Seeing none. And Representative Dingfelder, your concerns. I think we can wait and do that. So we'll.
Yeah, it's not a concern. I just would like to hear from the department. Yeah. That's all. And so if you can either have them come in or just, you know, get a letter from them or something, I think it would be good.
Okay. So I will close the hearing on House Bill 2974. And we'll open the hearing on House Bill 3043.
Again. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3043 authorizes the state forester to impose a civil penalty in an amount equal to the estimated cost of reforesting lands for violations under ORS 527-745 and to use the penalties to reforest the land that is the subject of the violation. And any penalties that exceed the cost of reforestation are to be paid to the general fund. There's no revenue impact, and we have not yet received a fiscal impact statement, no subsequent referral.
Okay, and we have Ted Lorenzen again from the Department of Forestry and Ray Wilson.
It's like the Ted and Ray show here.
You, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Ted Lawrence, Assistant State Forest in the Private Forest Division. Kind of the theme with this bill, as well as other bills, is trying to gain some efficiency in administration of the Forest Practices Act. A large part of that is because, quite frankly, the workloads and reduced resources the program has faced over the past decade has made us make some tough choices. And one of those choices has been related to reforestation, and we don't have good data on what kind of actual problem we have out there. Other than anecdotally, we know that we're seeing a fair amount of reforestation issues in what we'd call the developing areas. Due to lack of resources, we've made some choices actually to not look at parcels in areas that are developing that are less than 5 or 10 acres. So the kind of lands that we'd expect to have reforestation problems, we're not looking at. That being said, we've also talked to a fair number of folks that have identified a number of parcels that are 40, 50, 60 acres where there's additional problems occurring as well. Some of the reasons for that, basically reforestation is one of those things where the standards are fairly clear, but it's a temporal issue, and once you get into some of the temporal problems in terms of enforcement, the cost and complexity of achieving compliance goes up. This offers the efficiency of allowing us to put a penalty as early as possible in the process that would be equal to what we'd estimate to be the potential cost of reforestation. So it behooved the landowner to go forward and get the reforestation done as quickly as possible, as opposed to what we find now of dragging it out to try and really get to the point where we give up or where the costs become prohibitive for both parties. We do have authority to require repair, and we can actually go out and do the work and use that as a lien against the property. We've done that once. We actually owned the property. We couldn't afford to reforest it with any real dollars, so we went out and hand-planted it with staff, and then it was selling the property for much less than for what it cost us probably for doing the work, and got poison oak in the process. This is a tool that will hopefully help us do a better job, but it does not address the fundamental problems, the lack of resources. We do have some program, our policy option packages will restore those resources to allow us to start looking for these violations and be more aggressive about them. But this would be a tool that would help us given that additional resources.
So any questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a question, Ted. What is the estimated cost of reforestation? How come if you're going to do a bill, you can't get the actual cost?
Chair Roblin and Representative Smith, the cost of reforestation can vary quite a bit. And again, if you get reforestation done fairly early in the process, the cost per acre may be just a couple hundred dollars per acre. If you get into later times when vegetation management is going to become a big issue, the cost can go up dramatically. So that the cost would vary quite a bit. Obviously, the cost also varies based upon the size of the violation as well. And the civil penalties capped at $5,000 per violation. So using a 10-acre parcel, for example, this would cap the cost at $500 per acre, where if you're looking at a 40 or 50 acre, it would be something much less than that. And by raising that cap, we could, again, have a cost that would be proportionate to the estimated acreage and the cost and difficulty of that reforestation.
Yes.
I guess what it didn't, if you already know all that, depending on that, the bill you're going to send them, is it estimated? That's, I guess, what I'm trying to get at is you already know, after you've found them in violation and done all this and had to go out and reforest, don't you send them the bill then?
Chair Roland, Representative Smith, basically, if we were to do this violation process, we would come up with administrative rules that would establish the rate based upon some sort of parameters of difficulty and estimated cost. It is a civil penalty, so it's not something that we would reimburse back to the landowner if we overestimated. It's intended to be actually a big enough hook to say, we think it's going to cost $700 an acre if you keep doing what you're doing to reforest this. You got 40 acres. Here's our estimated penalty of whatever that is, $2,800 or $28,000, whatever it might be.
Right.
And that doesn't preclude us then from also using the other process of the repair order, but this would be something we could do much earlier in the process. And again, we do have authority to set up the civil penalty. So if they do mitigation or mediation type work, we could reduce that over time.
So they could work it off.
Yeah, they could work it off. And we've done that in the past on the, under the civil penalty authority we do have in place now with the CAP.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? So I guess how I'm reading this is what we're saying is we are going to reforest this land. And if they want to choose to do it, they can. And then that's great. They complied. If they aren't, we're going to fine them enough that we go out and get it redone.
Chair Roblin, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ray Wilkerson again, Oregon Forest Industries Council, testifying also in strong support of this bill as opposed to the last bill, which I said was the least important part of the Forest Practice Act. This one's probably the most important part. We take the requirement to reforest our harvested lands very seriously. It's what keeps that part of our economy going in perpetuity, which is capable of doing if it's taken care of and harvested lands are reforested promptly. And the department needs to have the resources to make sure that those laws are not violated or enforced. Frankly, in addition to the productivity of the land, our other motivation here is that we know that our practices are closely scrutinized by the public. That's forestry is unfortunately a controversial profession, and the public doesn't like clear cutting and timber harvesting very much. But if you ask them, do you know that the state law requires that those lands be replanted and reforested and a new forest be created, then they're much more comfortable with our practices. So we can't afford from a land productivity perspective and a public relations, if you will, perspective to have this law not be enforced. So that's our reason for our strong support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, I just have one question. I'm just going to ask you while you're here. What the quickest you have to do it is 12 months. You have to begin seed preparation. What's the long term? What's the longest you have?
Tree drill within five years.
5 years. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to House Bill 3043? Seeing none, we will close our hearing on House Bill 3043, and we will open a work session on 3043.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll move House Bill 3043 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith has moved House Bill 3043 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those wishing to in favor of the bill say aye. Those opposed, no. And we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Bauer?
Aye.
Representative
Smith?
Aye.
Representative Gokas? Excuse. Representative
Klein?
Aye.
Representative
Dinkel?
Aye.
And Chair Roblin?
Aye. The bill having received is passed. Out of the House, is this one? I don't think so.
I'll carry the bill.
Okay, like and we'll have Representative Smith carry the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good experience.
It's good experience.
I get to carry the bill.
It worked for moving.
We will close the work session on 3043, and we will close our hearing and our Committee of Ag and Natural Resources. So thank you very much.
Yes.